I hope you're aware that I am barely gonna scratch the surface. So there are some books that I suggested, and I don't want to sound discouraged, and I don't want to discourage you, but there is so much. There's a slight concern that you're gonna feel that we just touched something, and I didn't really give you a whole lot of answers. But what brings me in this field, I'll just share that a little bit. I'm a psychologist, clinical psychologist, study in secular world, and did that, the master's, and so this is, you know, the academic how to and what to, and then 3 years of psychotherapy, and then 2 years extra of psychotherapy, so that I can help people, and then master's in theology, and then PhD in mental health and theology, and this is part of my research. Pastor's wife for close to 30 years. We've been married 29, so 25 at least. Church planting. But I think I kind of, God gave me certain degrees that I didn't wish I got. And it's, some of them is living in Serbia, living in a broken country. So the forming years, the country was just falling apart. Just for example, I was born in the same building, in the same town, and even in the same building where my kids, three of my kids were born. We were all born in four different countries. I'm not exaggerating. I was born in Yugoslavia, in the same building. I had my firstborn. He was born in Yugoslavia, but Yugoslavia was a smaller, not six republics. Later on, I had a daughter that was, Benjamin was born in 1994. Sarah was born in 2000. At that time, that was Serbia and Montenegro. And then when Hannah was born, she was just born in Serbia. So that is the time that was kind of shaping. And in the midst of just us breaking, like that was not enough, then there was bombing. There was EU and United States bombing Serbia because of issues in Kosovo that are still happening. Even the bombing was 1999. 10 years of sanctions. That means that at one point I met a girl from Syria. So she's like, well, you get me. I do get her. We had the worst passport. Now they have the worst passport. So I married an American who came as a missionary to Serbia. All my life, I wanted to be a missionary. I didn't leave my own country. So also, I didn't want that. I came from a family that are not believers, and sadly, they're still not believers, my parents. Still alive, so still there's hope. I have three children. And Benjamin is 27, Sarah is 23, and Hannah's 18. My children went through a lot of health issue, mental issue, dealing with anxiety, phobia, OCD, depression. And my youngest daughter, Hannah, has a severe autism. So I don't know, all of that combined really broke me many times. And also, being therapist, listening to the people, being pastor's wife and listening to church people and the stories. For until my family started to break, I made this huge mistake thinking that's happening to them. And I'm just doing all the right things so it would not happen to me. I'm having a quiet time. I'm spending time with Jesus. I'm doing well. You know, my husband and I love each other, love our children. So it's like we're checking all the right boxes. But then when the things started happening, it really became overwhelming. And the question, why me? And actually, when we talk about this, there are certain, and I'm going to talk a little bit about and defining suffering, theodicy, pathos, evil, because we need to have the answers to that. And maybe you are a psychologist, maybe your background is not in theology, but you're going to come to God and ask these questions. How can a good, just God allow these things to happen? Can he stop? Can he heal my daughter? Can he interfere? Can he be the God of Daniel 2:20? He rules over everything. He puts the king. He is in power. So do I see the power of God in a shattered mind? And what do we do with this? John Swinton, the first recommendation, Google him, listen to him. Theologian that worked with people that were dealing with dementia from UK. This is what he says. The mental health problems are unique experiences that occur in the lives of irreplaceable individuals who have their own unique stories, histories, dreams, and desires. They are people with the dreams, stories, people who are loved by God and whom God desires God's church to love without boundaries. People's stories may be changed by their encounter with mental health problems, but they are not defined by them. We should not be defined by our primary family. I grew up in a dysfunctional family in a broken country. That affected me. That shaped me. That is not my identity. My identity is in Christ. The future is not defined by my DNA and my prime family that I grew up. It shaped me. It affected me. But God is in charge for what tomorrow brings. And why am I saying all of this? Because it really, when we put things in order, really helps us to know where we are and who we are and how we stand. I mean, it should. And that really powerfully affects everything we do and who we are in relationship with others. And I was telling in a counseling network, the most important thing in counseling is a counselor. His character and that he is rooted. I mean, where he stands, what he believes, who he is, it really is going to impact everything that happens in that hour or 2 hours. Who are we? Who is God? How would you define him? I mean, I ask that in therapy, but I will even ask you, who is God? If he is my father, that means I come to him, I run to him, I complain to him, I ask him for help. If he is my king, I bow to him, I honor him. And I know there are many layers who he is, but it really affects even how you pray or how your quiet time looks that day. It really shapes and also shapes how we look at the least, at the ones that are very unseen. The mental health challenges are, I sometimes say that it's so hard to raise children today. It was not easy in my time, but at least, you know, I kind of like to say we at least know who was the enemy. I don't know, sanctions or politicians. Today, the enemy can come from many places and have many shapes. He can come here. He can affect and touch our children. And these are how the mental health is defined by the World Health, National Alliance, or World Health Organization. Mental health illness is a medical, and I'm using different names. It's what we called mental illness. We're not calling illness. I'm not going to go into all of that right now. We don't have time. But I use right now mental health challenges and mental issues. But mental health challenges will be probably the name that I will use, even though this is a definition from National Alliance on Mental Illness in the United States. Mental illness is a medical condition that disrupts a person's thinking, feeling, mood, ability to relate to others, and at daily functions, and often results in diminished capacity for coping with ordinary demands. It is estimated that mental health disability affects about 10% of adult population at any moment, and at least 25% of individuals at some time. 25% of individuals in the countries like mine or in Syria or where the war is, the percentage can be even higher. But 25%, you know what that is? Like 25% of us is gonna ask for help from mental health professional or is gonna need the help, maybe it's not gonna ask. That means every fourth person. That means if there is like six people here in a room are going to need help. It's just think of your churches. Just think of when you sit on a bus, just there are much more that are going to need help than we are aware. And we are sometimes going to need probably help. This was done a long time ago, not a long time ago, 10 years ago. Amy Simpson and the book is here. I think the book is maybe called Shattered Mind. I have mentioned it in the papers, in your outlines. Her mom was diagnosed with schizophrenia. Her dad was a pastor, so she wrote a book from that perspective. And she did the study interviewing more than 1,000 people in the United States. And this is some of the statistics that she shared, that 98% were aware of mental disability in their congregation, yet fewer than 30% were equipped to respond completely. 44, which, I mean, this is United States, so I'll share a little bit of Serbia, what I did in my research. The church, 44 church leaders are approached 2 to 5 times per year to help dealing with mental, and actually that's pretty high. I think in my country, it's like 20-something will come. They will usually go to psychiatrist or psychologist. But 33% say that mental individuals never talked about their disability in the church. 37 say they will share with trusted friends. Only 12 will speak openly. 29, like one-third, never mental disability was never mentioned in the Bible. And she said that that is no casserole illness. Because now in our churches, we very often will speak about things that are, even addiction is not a taboo anymore. So we would ask for prayer, we would ask for help, we would be open, and we would go and visit somebody when they are dealing with, if they're diagnosed with cancer, if there's death in a family, how do we deal with this? And what do we do? How do we respond? And in my country, there's still a lot of shame that goes with many, many mental health issues. So we don't speak, so the families will not say. This is some of the statistics in Serbia. So I'm assuming that it's kind of like similar in Eastern Europe. A big assumption, I know that. It's different in Western Europe. It's actually a little bit better. So it was... this is a professor who did a study on 2,000 participants, questions and answers, and then the question was of mental health in Serbia in 2011, 2006. So some of his conclusions were that mental well-being in Serbia compared to the other European countries lower, especially Western European countries. Mental well-being significantly deteriorates among older women. Just in these 5 years, there was statistically a significant decline in mental health among the people. In 5 years, mental well-being is in general population has declined. Health system has not yet adequately responded to the burden of mental health disorders in Serbia. This is World Health Organization 2021. And between 76 and 85% of the people with mental health disorders receive no treatment for their condition. Scary. There's still a lot of shame. We don't talk about that. It is a lot of stigmas, and if it's interestingly enough, the ones that speak, and a lot of them are going to seek help and come to our churches. So how are we going to respond? And I think every time we see the social system failing, what an opportunity for believers to step in. And are we doing that? It's the question. I'm kind of quickly going to go through this. It is so interesting that this story... maybe I find it very interesting. In 1 Samuel 11, 16, when David is faking that he is mentally ill or something's wrong with him, what is so interesting about this text, I mean, seriously, at that moment, you can totally read it. He has the sword of a Goliath. He was kind of in a rush. You remember, he kind of ate what he, he's running away from Saul. He grabbed the Goliath sword. He has a Goliath sword with him. And then he is in a court of among Philistines. And he is a court of in King Achish court. And somebody recognizes him. And this is so interesting. The way he's behaving, he's not saying anything. They're assuming that he had mental health issues. Guys, they didn't have DSM or ICD. How do they know that this, this, and this? He's drooling. He's drawing. Like, even then, they had kind of like symptoms that will lead them to think this could be, So, I mean, me as a psychologist think that's kind of fascinating that we kind of, like, even at that time, they knew what will be, that something is not well and something is not there. I mean, the word was mentioned in Hebrew and in Greek that... I mean, we hear that Festus is going to tell to Paul that he's crazy. I mean, that is, that's you're out of your mind. Or to slave girl when she's coming, like, you're crazy. Yeah, that couldn't be, Peter at the door, you know. But if you want to do some quiet time, long moment and study, because there, I'm not trying to diagnose, and I'm mentioning here Saul, David, Saul, Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar acting like an animal. I'm not trying to diagnose them, even though here I am kind of connecting that the symptoms we see in David through the Psalms. So you're going to see the David symptoms and Bible references. And what I put here all the way to the left is it's actually characteristic symptoms for mnemonic device, meaning that every word means something. So the first word, mood, like, would he be today diagnosed with depression? You know, mood, his mood, his sleep, the guilt, the lost interest, everything that it's mentioned in the Bible. Why do I do all of this? I mean, like, what do we know? I need to prove something. I think that God gets it when we are down, when we're overwhelmed. I think there's a special, and I'm going to use a word that more often I use it now than I ever did. There's a mystery. And what is happening? Can somebody, I mean, the people will ask me, do I think that my daughter with autism can actually know God? Can somebody who's dealing with severe depression, somebody who has a manic, depressing, bipolar disorder, could they really know and meet Jesus? Can somebody diagnosed with severe schizophrenia know God? I mean, David is really, I love Job, and I'm so glad that Job is there. That is such a great story for every one of us. I don't know if you're aware of it, though. There is, and in Jeremiah, too, but Job, there is a good man that went through hell, lost everything, and he didn't do anything wrong. That is so good to know. That is so good that is there. Of course, sometimes, and I talk very often about pain and suffering, and that is probably one of my favorite topics. And of course, sometimes the pain and suffering and mental health issues could be, I mean, the first thing, there is an original sin, so if, you know, Eve didn't eat that apple, and if Adam would have stopped her, if that story would have went a different way, maybe we would never have this topic. But that happened, and of course there is sin that we can, there are stupid choices that we make that can really affect our life. But sometimes there is no that. Sometimes, seriously, there are Jobs in our church. And honestly, on the other hand, if somebody made stupid decisions, it's David. I mean, how many times, I would very often say, I'm glad I didn't marry David. I would totally go through divorce. I mean, seriously, look at what he did to his wives. I'm glad he was not my husband. I'm glad he's not my son. I'm glad he's not my pastor. I'm glad he's not my king. But then there are moments when I think, oh, he was a good husband and a good father. He was a good king. How do you explain that? How do you explain that he was man after God's own heart with all the mess in his life? And there is a lot of his own son stabbed him in the back. Wanted to get rid of him, wanted him dead. His own son raped his own daughter. his daughter, not his own. They're horrible things. David lied, David cheated, David cried, David wished ill upon others and did ill to others. What did Uriah do wrong? Except he had a beautiful wife. I mean, there are a lot of things in a Bible, guys. There are a lot of things that are going to make you think and wonder. And I don't know how I went through life until my life started falling apart. And I was one of the first to get COVID, usually me and my colleague. And I'm thinking, seriously, God, can somebody else go with that in a church? I don't have to have like that also. Like, she just got, you know, in the beginning, that was a big thing. Later on, everybody had it. But I'm like, okay, God, seriously. But when you really read the Bible, look at all these heroes. What was Elijah dealing with? What was Jeremiah dealing with when in Jeremiah 17, he said to God, and I love how openly they speak to God. And I think their openness in their conversation with God is really an invitation for a prayer and conversation for every one of us. Jeremiah is going to tell God, why have you used me and abused me? I mean, if that is not an invitation for us to say everything, I mean, there are a lot of things that I told God because I've been seeing how broken my kids, my family, I mean, it first started with my country and my first family, but then later on with the other family, that I thought that I did everything right. All the ducks were in a row. And I really, very naively, I thought, and why me? Well, let's just put that aside. There's only one that suffered and didn't deserve, and he chose. That's Jesus Christ. That's only one. All of us, we have capacity to do amazingly stupid things, all of us. As somebody said, we all have a capacity even to kill. We have just not met the right person. But if we think something bad upon someone, we have done it. So there's a big chance that all of us in one way have committed adultery and murder and who knows what. And he died for our sins, and we are free from that. But why am I saying all of this, and why am I putting all of this on us? Because I really hope that you're going to start looking at the people that sit across from you, that you talk with your friends, with your family, with your children, with people you counsel differently. Just have much, much more mercy and grace and love. Somebody told me, take your shoes off when they share their pain. Take your shoes off, you're standing on a holy land. It's very often the land where they're gonna meet Jesus. And maybe we're gonna see him too. So this is a very amazing quote, and I love that of all the misery that people experience, sickness is greater than any of them. It is the immediate sword of God. In poverty, I lack things, and in banishment, I lack the company of others, of other people, but in sickness, I lack myself. It is hard. Why do I mention, I want to just follow, why Imago Dei? But God created us in his image. And there's, you know, through Reformation and everything, what does that mean? How am I the image of God? And the image of God, and how do you perceive who you are, and where is God's image in you? It has really shaped the history. It really shapes who we are. Is my daughter less the image because she has autism? Is she? Is somebody who has Alzheimer less him, less the image of God because he has Alzheimer? What does that mean? And I am, you know, doing a PhD in theology, but I want to say I'm not a theologian. Well, maybe hopefully I'm going to be one day, but they are probably one of the reasons I chose theology later on, not PhD in psychology, because I realized that I was seeking the answers. If we're all created in his image, how does that shape my therapy and the way I view human beings? If he's a good God, how do we explain the evil and suffering? And there's some amazing books. I mean, Jürgen Moltmann, if you guys love philosophy, amazing story of a young man who ended up in being a teenager in a Nazi Germany and ended up in prison because the last couple of months he was 17, so he fought on German side. He's going to be for 3 years in a prison in Ireland, I think, where he's going to get a New Testament, and he's going to say, and he's going to write a book, The Only Suffering God Can Understand My Suffering. I mean, kind of like Bonhoeffer too. Only the God that suffers gets it. He gets it. And when we think, and we sadly, because of the influence of Greeks and, you know, all these, you know, great minds, I think, therefore I am. So whoever thinks less, he is less. Is she less? Is my daughter less? The gap between me and my daughter with autism is nothing compared to me, the gap between me and Heavenly Father. And he chooses to, I mean, when Jesus came in Philippians 2, I mean, he invited us to come and join the fellowship of what? Suffering. And don't get me wrong, I know how to have fun, and Serbia people do know how to have fun. And I'm half Romanian, that just adds more fun to us. So we just laugh and dance and rejoice. But there is suffering. And he said that that's going to happen. There is challenges in suffering. And he did say that we're going to. But also, if in Hebrew 4, he needed to learn, through suffering, Jesus learned the obedience. Why do we think we're going to get easier? I mean, I think if you live and breathe, you're going to experience pain in life. If you choose that pain to bring to him, you're going to experience extreme joy and holiness in his presence. What he can do with all the shattered, it's much better, much more powerful than kintsugi. I don't know if anybody's familiar with sugi method in Japan. That with the broken pottery, they put it together with gold. I think that's what our God does. And it's beautiful and marvelous. Why the image? Why is it so important? Because in the Nazi Germany, when everything happened, majority of them were Christians. Rwanda. It was the war between the Christians. It was a slaughter. And who were the Nazi Germany killing first? The people with disability, because they were less. I mean, when we read what they did in 18th and 17th century and how they treated people with mental health issues, it is because they were considered to be animals. So you could leave him outside, you could beat him, you could not feed him, you could treat him any way you want, you could do that to, you know, kind of dog, cats. They're like animals. And some of the methods when we read in school were terrifying. And you know who did, when you read in the history of church, there's just amazing stories, what some people, what some Christians chose to do. And it was in the Second World War when the Methodists didn't want to go and fight. And they actually, there's a story, you can read this, you can find it online. The story that they didn't want to go and fight in war. They want to, you know, bear the arms. And then there were 5,000 people, men, that were placed in asylums in the United States at that time during the war. What they did, they moved with their families. And very often, there were one or two on hundreds of people with mental health issues, severe mental health issues. They didn't train them. They didn't tell them what to do. They just said, make sure they're alive and just be there. They don't kill each other. So these people came and lived with them. What happened, that is going to shape the whole way how the whole system is later on going to treat the people with mental health issues. And when they ask them, why did you do what you did? They said, we just want to show them a little bit of heaven. They respected them. They cared for them. They were doing such a good job that kind of like the whole system forgot that there were these Methodists taking care of them, that they stayed longer than the war was. And that really shaped. That's when we are who are we called to be, and when that shapes our way that we see and think, it really moves and shapes our surrounding, our environment. Who we are, the core of who we are in him, it is really, when we are rooted in him, it really shapes everything around us. And that is amazing and powerful. Dr. Anderson did a lot of his, I think PhD was on disability and inclusion. God's image in human beings is neither diminished by disability, not confirmed by our abilities. Blohara talked in the beginning. There's a book, you can see the Genesis and the creation. I think they have it here, great books, and great theologian. He talks about the image of God. And I'm going to mention, and actually her story, Nancy Island, our bodies participate in the Imago Dei, not in spite of our impairments and contingencies, but through them. She died in her 40s because of cancer, but she lived in a wheelchair all her life. And there is a book that she wrote, Disabled God. The gap, what God did to come to this earth was much, 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 much more bigger than if I would choose to be in a wheelchair for the rest of my life to understand people with disability. And she really says that we, I think our whole hermeneutics, our whole the way we perceive God and read the Bible is he's able-bodied. His body was broken for us. He was a he sacrificed himself for us. He was beaten. I mean, I just read Isaiah and let's read what happened to him. So it's very interesting how she, and the way these people that when they explain what it is, how mental disability or disability, how that shapes human being and what that can do in them. I mean, for a while, I think Greg and I were church planters, so we were in a new city, and, you know, as I said, at one point, everything looked great. We had three kids, you know, at a cute church, everything was great. We had even a golden retriever. Everything was just amazing. And then something was different with Hannah, and she was, when she was two, this is in 2007, she was diagnosed with autism. For many years, there were a lot of things that I never shared, because I was embarrassed. I didn't know what to do. We were the first ones that didn't know what to do with Hannah in our church. Like, what all of us, we want to have in a Sunday school, cute kids to know how to color. So, I mean, who wants in a church somebody who's going to start yell something? Faster! I mean, seriously. You know, even when I talk about, you know, personality disorders, I'm like, they're difficult people that are around us. And very often personality disorders are the difficult people that were abused and mistreated when they were young. And what do we do when they're acting weird? We mistreat them, and we are hard with them. And it's not easy, guys. It's not easy. And I am not, don't get me wrong, I'm not glorifying disability and mental health issues or autism in any way. It's horrible. I hope, and I can wait, if he doesn't do it on this part of the heaven, I can wait to have conversations with Hannah and see Hannah whole. But it kind of opened my eyes to the world that I was blind to. And I remember, actually, that's kind of how it started, all my conversations with God is, I don't think you get it. I don't know if you really get it. Your kids are kids. You have typical kids. Your son was typical. He chose to go on a cross. I don't know if you understand. I mean, yeah, who am I? And I actually, it's since then, and it's been 16 years of autism in my house, that God's been showing me on many levels how autistic I am. And guys, we are. And it's, again, I'm not trying to minimize autism and say, oh, we are all kind of autistic. No. I mean, but for example, if you think that you are a typical son of God or daughter of God, are you going, I have two typical kids. So you know how that goes. You know, you want to kick him out of your home and you want to help him as much as you can. They're going to call you less and less. They're going to call you for a while, you know, when they need money, they need something, and they're growing into independence. Is that how your relationship with God is? And if it is, that's scary. I'm utterly dependent on him. And when I remember when I screamed to God, I can't be Hannah's mom. I'm not doing a good job. I don't have a clue what to do. Yes, I studied psychology. Then I did master's in children's psychopathology. And I still said, I don't know how to do it. I would do it for a few hours maybe somewhere, but not in my home for 24. And I really felt God telling me, and I had a lot of conversations, you don't know what to do with the other kids and you never ask me. And that's true. I thought I got it. And actually, I think Hannah helped me be a better parent to them. Hannah helped me listen differently, be more present. And the assumptions that we have. Guys, most of the times, your hindrances, your issues in relationship with God are not going to be your disabilities, but your abilities. Everything that you can, you're going to be trying to do without him. And that is not going to end well. It's going to be hurting others and hurting you. And not doing what he called us to do. Because honestly, when we are desperate and broken, when we kind of empty ourselves, it's kind of like what Jesus did in Philippians 2. When we choose to be that, to be nothing and be servants. I mean, is every pastor that finishes theological faculty or like seminary, is he willing from now on, I am going to have disturbed sleep. I'm going to pray a lot. I'm going to serve them. I'm going to love them. I'm going to be there for them. I'm going to take care of the ones that nobody wants to take care of. Nobody wants to do that. But that is the calling. I mean, that is the calling of every believer. But we cannot do it without him. So praise God for brokenness. And I'm not, as I said, I'm just kind of scratching on the surface. Are the demons, is that what it is here when we talk about mental health issues? And let me just, I'm open to go there, even though that is, let me first read this. I love John Swinton. This is what he said. It always struck me as a rather odd that some people feel comfortable using the language of the demonic around some of the most vulnerable people in the world, but tend not to use that kind of a language when talking about corrupt politicians, bankers, and lawyers, an oppressive social and legal system, the places where significant demonic activity occurs. Bless his heart. Why do I always get the answer? Do you think it's demonic? Do you think it's Satan? Actually, could be, but not any less among everybody else. Politicians, lawyers, social workers, everywhere else. So why do we think that they're the ones that kind of like, and also, like, this is what it was from the book Stanford, he did, Matthew Stanford did a lot of study on mental health. It was his PhD, and you can find a lot of books to great, great insight. So when we see devils at work, and this is what he said, we have 31 specific instances of healing by Jesus or his apostles. Only 5 of those illnesses are said to have resulted from the demonic influence. So how does devil work? Temptation. This is what we see in the Bible. He was tempting Jesus. Deception. Accusation. And then impairment, suffering, and sickness. So I can ask every one of you, is it demonic when you are dealing with issues? So it is, and maybe the right question will be, is it spiritual? And I would also answer, it is always spiritual. Because we are spiritual, we are physical beings, but it's like saying, no, it's not physical. Well, maybe with some mental health issues, we know that there are some organic changes, so then we call it's the body. So there's always that nature versus nurture. Was it something that, you know, the environment, you know, a hostile environment or war or trauma? And yes, all of that can affect. And also, if in a family you have a history of depression, yes. But guys, okay. Just recently in the world history, we know what the DNA does. We know that it can cause cardiovascular issues and problems and, you know, the color of my eyes and a lot of things we know. We didn't know that. I mean, that's pretty recent. So now there are more and more studies showing even changes on DNA because of trauma and even changes in our brain because of that. And that is also shaping the next generation. So there are people talking, I mean, this is a whole amazing topic, but let's not go there. Transgenerational trauma. So if my dad was in jail during communism and my grandpa was in jail during the Second World War, is that affecting my son? Yes. Do I know how? No. Again, I don't want to underestimate the power of Jesus. So it's not the DNA that is going to define my future, because Jesus is more powerful, but it's certainly in some way going to shape. And in a weird way, I actually think that autism gave me a ticket or a passport to a world that I didn't really want to go and visit, but I ended up being a missionary there. So I actually think the mental health issues also do. I actually think there are traumas and our brokenness can do that too. And it's, as John Piper put it, and John Erickson taught it, do not waste your cancer. That was, I think, John Piper's sermon once. Do not waste your suffering and pain. Do not waste. And help someone who sits across from you shape that for his glory. And it's not easy. But you know what? When it's not easy, when you're constantly broken and you need help, there's an opportunity to constantly come to the helper, to the redeemer, to the one that gives life, to the one. I love, there are a lot of stories in the Bible that I love, but the stories in John 4 when he meets the Samaritan woman, it never crossed my mind until recently. When he's even asking her, so yeah, go and call your husband. I don't have a husband. Yes, you're right. You don't have a husband. The one you're living is not your husband. You know the story. She had sex. And it's the way he arranged to meet her. And it's, as a joke, I love to say, because he had 12 man apostles, he needed to send all 12 to buy him food. If he would have had a woman, that would be differently. But all 12 went to get food. He stayed there. The way he arranged to meet her. Do you know where we see in the Bible also somebody meeting at the well? Couples. Spouses. It is so powerful that we see that at the well, Jacob found his wife. At the well, the spouse, the couples meet. Moses met his wife. And it's so amazing. He came to fulfill that huge need that she had. And you know what happens? At the well, they meet, and then later on, they go to the family, and they have a meal and arrange the marriage. Do you know where Jesus ate? The apostles came with food. Did he eat there? No, he went to Samaria, and he stayed there. He knows the deep cry. And to me, if somebody has such a brokenness and deep cry, what an opportunity for our Lord to come and meet the need. So in one way, I'm not glorifying brokenness and suffering, but the more I'm empty and broken, the more room for him to be and to dwell. And then what an opportunity for us to bring him to someone who is broken, who is empty, who is lost. So could it be? Yes. Is it always? I don't think so. There are answers that I said that you will need to have. And the answers, I'll come back to that, on suffering, theodicy, pathos. I love, pathos is actually Abraham Heschel that brought into in his book on where God reacts. Pathos is, well, actually, let me go through. Theodicy is the word, is derived from Greek, and it explains a perfectly good and almighty God, and all-knowing God will permit evil. Justifying God, that's what theodicy means. How do you justify God in the midst of evil? And the people are going to ask you that. And very often we are not going to have answers, and it's okay. There's just sometimes a mystery. And it's okay with God, it's okay to have mysteries. I mean, how did we become a believer? It's a mystery. Why was I at one point open that never ever heard the gospel in the age of 17? I was thirsty and hungry, and I came to that well and met him. It's a mystery. So there are a lot of things, but pathos is just such a sweet word that the element of experience of an artistic representation of compassion, sympathetic pity, and it's Heschel translating from Hebrew that God shows his love, his passion, and his emotion, and he shows and gives and pours himself to us. It's kind of one of those, the hineni word, that is amazing word, mentioned I think 5 or 6 times in the Bible, and it's very often it's the word that actually people will say, and we see it in the Old Testament, here I am. I am here completely present and available to you, God. And we see Abraham saying that, hineni, I am here completely, totally. You have me. You have everything that I have. It's yours. You know what is so amazing in Isaiah? God uses that word for us. Here I am, completely ready, available to be here for you. I mean, if the women don't like that God, made us as a helper, the same word that is used for Eve as a helper is the word that is used for God to be to us, a helper. It is amazing. And why do I say that? It is, in Brother Karamazov, there's a story that actually one brother is a priest, and it's amazing. If you want to read the Samara novel, that is great and amazing. And I actually really think that we're going to meet Dostoevsky in heaven. And but it's there is, he even talks about this theodicy. How do you, so one brother is explaining why God allowed, and there's really not the answer that he is giving, but he tells the story of a boy that was awfully abused. And this is what Ivan Karamazov says, in the whole universe were the tears of the tortured child. How do you answer? How do you, I mean, if you are pastor, counselor, if you are a believer, how do you deal with these issues? And these are hard. And I invite you to deal with them, to go into the Bible and look. Jeremiah said, I mean, it's, you used me and abused me. It is also that Abraham Heschel said that a lot, that Jeremiah used a word, abuse, that was used to explain what happened to David's daughter that was sexually abused. That means that he's applying, you abused me to the point of, to the core and shame, you shamed me. And sometimes even in therapy, when the people are complaining what did and somebody did and how, like very often I said, do you want me to save you time? Who are you actually angry here at? If God is a powerful God and can stop, and he didn't stop. And so I make them be angry at God, but I really want to bring him to the one that has the answers. The one that just makes the whole story, the broken pottery, whole and beautiful. He does that. I don't have an answer. I don't have an answer why autism and why brokenness in my children's life. And very often, I am not the answer to a lot of their needs. I'm not. I mean, as a joke, I told my teenage daughter once, people pay me to listen to me, and I'm willing to do it for free for you. And she didn't help. She didn't listen. But it's, I really very often don't have the answer. But I choose not to leave. I choose not to go. I choose to see. I choose to speak the truth. And guys, that is so powerful. The first time that somebody gives God a name, do you know who it is? Hagar. A slave. Abused slave. Her body was being used for the purposes of her master. And then she was just kicked out. She is the one Egyptian abused slave that gives God the name for the first time in the Bible. Up to then, he's Yehovah, he's Yahweh. And then he's the God that sees. The God that sees, it's also very, could be very unpleasant. Read 139 Psalm. Where do I go from you? You're ahead of me. You know every thought. You're in front of me. You're behind me. You know everything. And where can I go? But then if you choose to be vulnerable and open up, then he ends the psalm, know me and search me. But it's a struggle and it's not easy. And guys, whatever brought you here, and if it's somebody else, the major work that God is going to do in the life of that person that you would like to help is going to be in your heart. And it already may be started. And for a whole time, I think, and I tried so hard to find the right therapy, the right healing, the right help for Hannah. I want to fix Hannah, help Hannah, get the best out of her, let her be able to live in this world. But I think the whole time God was working on me, trying to shape me into something that he likes the most, and that is the likeness and the look of his son in us. So I really thought that she needs a lot of fixing. And the world will certainly say, because she's invalid in the eyes of the world. And I thought we have to fix her to be as much able and valid for this earth. And I can tell you some of the tough decisions. And here are some, again, amazing book. She is actually, I think, maybe Presbyterian pastor or something like that. She dealt with depression. And also, guys, have you read a Psalm 88? That is a psalm that doesn't have one single, like, smidget of hope. And that's the name of her book, The Darkness is My Only Companion. She explains the depression that is so deep. When I'm depressed, every thought, every breath, every conscious moment hurts. One very important way to help her, then she goes on. But she says it's like walking on a broken glass. That's how it feels constantly. She says, it's like mourning the death of my children, but they're not dead. It is so, so hard. What is the task for mental health professionals is discerning the underlying psychological reasons for someone feeling this way. And I am all there, and I want to do that. I love doing that. I love helping mental health professionals be better in their work. But what is the task for the church? Understanding and responding to the feelings of loneliness that they're dealing. And it's Jürgen Moltmann that once said, for the solution for poverty is not property, but community. I don't think that the solution for mental health is health. I really think it is the community. And we have an amazing opportunity to provide divine community to care for them. Caring for the needs of the people living with mental health problems is not an option for the church, rather is a primary mark of its identity and faithfulness. I love John Vinier. A lot of great things in a world of actually disability. But I love his quote, we are called to do not extraordinary things, but very ordinary things with an extraordinary love that flows from the heart of God. Very ordinary things. Walk with them. Be there. See them. Hear them. Provide them an opportunity to be part of the community. So it is actually John Swinton and also Eric Johnson in his book that so these terminologies I kind of took from them, but I love it, that we can provide liturgical healing. We can provide healing of dignity, like that Imago Dei to pour into them. You know how many times if I would have told you, like right now, if I would have told you like one number, 356, and I say, I'm not going to repeat this number anymore, but if you know this number in an hour, I'm going to give you a reward. If you don't know this number in 1 hour, I'm going to punish you. If you're going to know the number tomorrow, I'm going to give you a bigger reward. If you forget the number tomorrow, the punishment is going to be bigger. What are the chances that you're going to remember one number? Pretty high. There are things that were said to us when we were children, over and over and over again. And very often they did follow punishment or reward. You're stupid. You look ugly when you cry. Oh, stop it. The boys don't cry. Come on, toughen up. Stop it. Why are you doing that? Look at you. Why are you not more like this, this, and this? There are so many messages we poured and then we watered with reward or with punishment or however. And it doesn't have to be us, and it's not always the parents, and very often it is the parents. But we have to remember that the parents were the children that were also being treated in quite a lot of ways. So how powerful is the word that we speak? And what shapes our identity and who we are? And the word, in speaking the truth, I sometimes just tell somebody, I'm going to be walking with you. People that are dealing with mental health issues are so confused to the point that, just think if you would have walked in a tunnel and it's completely dark, and then you do quite a few circles, and you don't really know where the exit is and where you are going deeper in the darkness. So sometimes it's just saying, I'm going to walk by you, and I'm going to walk with you to the light. I'm going to call the things, I'm going to give the things the name and name them the way they are. That was abuse that happened. That was mistreating. That was evil. Because the people are confused. What happened to me? Have I done something wrong? So sometimes it's just, and even with the non-believers, I just say, I'm going to speak the truth. And I mean, isn't that what we're all called as believers? To speak the truth? To speak the word? To bring the light? And what an opportunity do we have to do that. And very often, I mean, I go even into more and like deeper things. What can we do? Like, for example, there's a church that decided to have once a month the whole worship geared towards people with autism. So the lights are more dim, the music is softer. Everybody just tries to accommodate and help them be welcomed. What is there that we can do? guys, there is no guarantee. Actually, there is a guarantee that every one of us is going to deal with some sort of disability eventually and an illness. Well, death. Every one of us. I mean, the idea that I have two typical kids and one child with autism, it's today. They could be a drunk driver, you know, or they can be in a car accident. We don't know what tomorrow brings. And the idea that it doesn't happen to us, it's actually very foolish and very naive. And how are we treating the ones that are, I mean, elderly, majority of our church are elderly. I mean, I need glasses now. It's like, well, that's already, you know, I'm going into the, like, my back hurts. It's, we have a singer in Serbia, when you're over 40 and nothing hurts, you're probably dead when you wake up, you know. It's like, so it's, it is, what do we do to make, how do we, how cautious are we, like, even how we read the scripture, how we speak the truth into their life. So what can we do to bring the healing in worship, in teaching, hearing their story? And this is actually somebody else did this two parts. I kind of added the other. The first one is what somebody who's dealing with mental health issue goes through. They go first to distress, and then they need, it's when acute mental health issue happens, it's distress is the first thing. And then you need to bring stability. And then you need kind of function, everyday functioning. And then they're going to go towards the purpose. Okay, so now I can, I mean, if you, in the midst of distress, severe distress, I mean, it's, for example, if somebody is having a psychotic episode on a second year in college, you're not going to talk to them. So when are you thinking of planning, of finishing college, and what, where are you going to apply for work? No, you want to bring the stability. So the second road that you see, it's what the family does. When they're distressed, the family, they are in the role of caregivers. When they're looking for stability and their stability that is being implanted in their life, they're kind of manager, helping them to manage that routine, to get up, to shower, to go for a walk. When they're functioning, they're their partners. When they have a purpose, they are family. So it is kind of like once in a while, you kind of have to kind of like go, like even with the typical kids, you know, they have stages and then they regress when they're going through. For example, I'm going to just give a silly, like if a toddler learn how to, you know, use the potty and it's not using a diaper and something happens shocking, very often they're going to go back to diapers and we don't make a big deal. We just say, okay, let them regress and let's take another, again, the steps through maturity and growing and healthy and all of that. And we don't make a big deal out of it. But here, when somebody's kind of like withdraws, let's say in a severe clinical depression, or as I said, a psychotic episode, we just really need to be a caregiver. Call 911, call the doctors, look for help, make sure they're not going to hurt themselves. All of that, be a caregiver, help them. They take their medication. They are going to go for a walk. They're going to see their doctor, that's manager. Partner, we are there. I'm going to go with you. Do you want somebody to go with you to church? I'll go gladly. You prefer this church or this service? I'll be there. Family, do you want to go and finish that college? I'm here to help you. So what I added is what the church can do. And sometimes, very often, the people that are really helping and pouring into the lives of people dealing with mental health issues is the family. And we have an opportunity to be alongside the family. Help these parents be well. So we just choose to be present. To be present there. Be present for, if they're going to call the 911 and go, I'm going to go and maybe pray for this parents, or just say, I'm here, I'm praying for you, let me know. And here I come. And it's maybe, I'm going to drive your typical kids to school and help you. The next one is support. What can you do while they're managing? What are the thing that kind of physical, practical things that I can do. Okay, don't worry about meals or whatever. So it's really, you come along family and everybody there. And then you are involved in their partnering. What are the things? And they're very often, I remember speaking with the people that are in a ministry. And I know parents and moms that will come and say, if the pastor can come, youth pastor can come and walk alongside my husband is not here, he's working somewhere else, or if they would come and walk alongside my son that is dealing with certain issues. And that's where that involvement is. And finally, when they have a purpose and there's a family, there's a fellowship. We want fellowship, and when they cannot be part of the fellowship, we kind of exclude them. We don't know what to do with them. I mean, it's valid, it is overwhelming. So if you want to read something, and if you, well, this is going to be a fun theology of disability, a fun summer reading. As I mentioned, her, Nancy Iceland, it's just her story. I mean, she's, as I said, theologian and sociologist. Amazing story of her life and meeting Jesus in all of that. And her book is Disabled God. And I actually, in a weird way, I hope you would meet this God too. Our God is very powerful. Our God has many faces, in a good way, I mean. And it's, okay, let me just tell you, and the other story, who was there that I wanted to, it's okay. Well, let me just tell you something about Hannah, and then I'm going to give you a few minutes for questions. Somebody was asking me what we are planning with Hannah. Hannah's 18, and it's challenging and it's overwhelming. And a friend of mine is here that is Hannah's assistant, and she knows how overwhelming. Hannah has at least 2 tantrums a day. That means she screams, and we don't even know why and how. And then somebody in our group was asking, can Hannah really know God? I actually think that she does. And I don't even know how to explain to you why and how I think, but there are many stories of Hannah. But there is something that it's we did consider, and we have a nonprofit. We're working with a family that are affected with disabilities, and we would love to see a Christian center in the Balkans and a home where God-fearing people will welcome people with disability and love them. And we see that in large communities. Henry Nouwen has lived the last years of his life in one of those communities. And the story of Adam, if you want to read that he wrote, is very powerful and amazing. But my husband and I were talking, and we were very reluctant because, of course, Serbians, the options in Serbia for people like Hannah are terrifying. I mean, we kind of made into a BBC quite few documentaries that are kind of like, you know, nerve-wracking and chilling, and yeah, forget that. So, but anyways, I'm, again, complaining to God, and there's really nothing, and it's really hard, and we're exhausted. So, God, what do you want, and how can we do, and what can we do? And God actually reminded me of something, because he was reading and preparing for all of this. There was one woman that was dealing with bipolar disorder, and she's a doctor, but for her to be able to work as a doctor, she will have to be on medication. But very often when she's manic, she will have this vision, and she would meet God, and she's really close to God. And when she's on medication, she would not spend that much time with God and just kind of feel distant from God. And when she would approach the pastors and they were theologians, they would usually say, well, maybe that was not God that you were meeting in your manic moments, which is true and it's possible. But actually, very rarely anybody will say maybe it was God. Could a shattered mind in the midst of chaos and screaming and craziness and autism meet God? How do we know that they can't? Who are we to say this is the way we do? I mean, it's where most of the conversation happened with prodigal son and his father. In the head of a prodigal son. He didn't open his mouth, and the father embraced him, and the father waited for him. And of course, we know that when we say and confess that I'm not, you know, denying any of that. But what I wanted to tell you, it's the story of Hannah, that we have a experience when Hannah actually share the gospel with somebody. And 3 years ago, there was a girl watching Hannah that is not a believer and just Orthodox background, but never heard the gospel. And she was watching Hannah. Greg and I went for dinner. We came back, and I was sharing already this story in my group, so sorry. But it's a she comes, and we come home, and this girl is in tears, and we were like, whatever happened, don't worry, it's okay, you know. And she says, no, Hannah asked me to pray for her. Hannah never asked before or after. This was 4 years ago, so never before, never after. We prayed for her, but she never said, pray for me. She asked this girl to pray for her. So the girl says, I don't know how to pray. How about you pray? And then Hannah said, thank you, God, for mom and dad, spaghetti and tablet. Well, you can imagine what her life is. But, and Hannah says, amen, and Hannah went to bed. And this girl said, I don't know what happened, but since then I've been crying. And my husband and I would sit down and we said, I think Hannah brought you in the presence of Jesus. And we share the gospel. She's a believer. She is in our nonprofit working and serving family with disability. But a year ago, when I came to God and said, what do we do with Hannah? You know, with the typical kids, you know, come on, go, be a doctor, be something, you know, bring cute babies, grandkids, and don't bother us too much, don't ask a lot of money, and we're going to have a happy life, you and I. But what do you do with Hannah's? And I really felt God saying, who are you to say that she cannot be my witness? In a story, I think it's Luke 17, when he tells the disciples, when actually the Pharisees come and say, come on, look what your disciples are doing. And he says, if they would not speak, even the rocks would. Who are we to say that children with autism, people with schizophrenia, people with depression cannot be his witnesses and meet him? Who am I to say that Hannah's life is not going to have any purpose from now on? And I really felt God telling me, I want to send her. So let's look. Where's the place where she would go and be a missionary? Who are you to say that I cannot use her for my glory? And I just hope and pray for every one of you that you are going to see the Imago Dei. You're going to see the purpose. You're going to see the hope. You're going to see the light that he can bring in every broken human being, in us and in every one of them.